Part 2 Chapter 15 Avery "Just a man I met at the gym," Marissa had said during our first session. It's 9:45 a.m. right now, the time of day Marissa usually departs Pinnacle Studio and heads to Coco to open the store. I arrived early for Pilates and have been lingering on a mat, stretching since the class let out. Pinnacle is quiet. The pre-work rush is over. A few guys lift barbells in the weight room, and another is tearing up the treadmill. The friendly manager, who came over to introduce himself yesterday when I was bending over the water fountain to get a drink, is in his office chatting on the phone. They all seemed like possibilities at first, but nothing is clicking. The manager told me his husband taught a HIIT class that I had to try. The weight room guys, who barely look 30, seem hyper-focused on their routines, and the runner doesn't even shift his gaze when an attractive woman in a crop top and leggings saunters by in front of his treadmill. It's more than that, though. I've gotten to know Marissa, and my gut tells me she isn't the kind of woman to have a one-night stand with a mere acquaintance. I'll bet anything she's still holding a big secret or two. I hurry into the locker room and shrug on my light jacket. The first hint of spring is in the air, which I was especially grateful for on my early morning walk with Romeo, then wave goodbye to the front desk clerk, a college-age guy with a tattooed neck, Marissa would never go there, and push through the door, scanning my surroundings as I head back to my car. As I pull into a parking spot across the street from Coco, I imagine I am Marissa Bishop. I've risen with the sun to make breakfast for my family in our luxurious kitchen. I've exercised and showered, and now I'm dressed for the day. Let's say in a casually chic pair of dark rinsed jeans, suede ankle boots, and a fitted blazer. I'm about to enter my charming boutique, my favorite creation after my son, where I'll chat with customers and select new inventory from vendors around the world. I'll likely run out to pick up a salad for lunch, and during slow moments, I'll catch up on paperwork. It's not the kind of life I'd ever want, but I know it's an enviable one for many women. I've chosen this time of day to visit Coco because during our session last night, when I posed questions designed to better understand their daily routines, Marissa lamented that the upcoming school auction was infringing on her finely calibrated schedule. My co-chairs want to meet after drop-off tomorrow, but that means I'll probably get to Coco late. Matthew had pointed out that although Marissa was feeling increasingly annoyed by Polly, this was another reason to keep Polly employed, at least for a little while longer. Polly should be here alone. It will be simple enough to say I'm searching for a present for my stepdaughter. I stroll down the sidewalk, past a coffee shop and a dry cleaner's, my ears filling with the rush of cars passing by on Connecticut Avenue. I spot the royal blue logo of Marissa's store painted on its glass front windows and step inside, triggering a bell that jingles merrily. A young woman who must be Polly is talking to a male customer toward the back of the store. They're partially obscured by a pillar.
"Be right with you," Polly calls,
and her customer, tall, blonde, wearing a dark suit, turns around. It's Matthew. I take a step closer to them just in time to see Matthew grab what appears to be a document off a glass table.
"Avery, long time no see. What are you doing here?"
It's almost comical, the way he's hiding the paper behind his back, like a little kid caught sneaking a cookie. "Hi, Matthew." I move closer to him with each word. "I suppose I could ask you the same question.
You two know each other?"
Polly's head swivels between us. Instead of answering her question, Matthew responds to mine. He uses his free hand to lift up a bouquet of red roses from the table.
"Thought I'd surprise Marissa. If anyone is going to give my wife flowers, it's me. Unfortunately, I forgot she has some auction thing at the school."
Marissa mentioned her committee meeting just last night, but Matthew has a lot on his mind. I take a closer look at him. He seems tightly wound, as if he just drank a triple espresso.
His body appears rigid and his jaw is clenched.
Hi, I'm Polly, Marissa's assistant. Can I help you find something?
She seems a bit hyped up, too. I can practically see the jittery waves radiating off her. I wonder what I've interrupted and whom the flowers are really for. I take measure of Polly, just as I evaluated the men at the gym. Young, skinny, big teeth, a voice that's a bit high-pitched. I can't see Matthew being interested. As I reach this conclusion, Matthew releases a sigh.
Polly, I don't think Avery is here to shop.
He turns to me.
Am I right?
I nod. There's no point in lying. Matthew knows I've been probing aspects of his and Marissa's lives outside of my office. Matthew says to Polly,
Avery is a therapist who is helping Marissa and me.
His candor surprises me, especially since I recommended the bishops keep my involvement in their life quiet for now. Plus, most guys wouldn't freely admit they're in counseling, and given my true title, Matthew didn't even need to explain my role in the bishop's life at all. Polly simply stands there, her hands clasped in front of her. She doesn't seem terribly surprised by the news or by Matthew's having shared something so highly personal. I fervently hope no other customers enter the store now. I need to understand the strange energy coursing around Matthew and Polly.
Actually, Avery, maybe it's a good thing you showed up.
Matthew slowly pulls the document from behind his back. It's an ordinary white piece of paper, the kind everyone uses to stock printers.
Polly found this note slipped under the door this morning when she opened up.
Matthew places the single sheet on the table, and I look down at the words. They're typed in a large, bold font. I'm not letting you go so easily. I glance over at Polly. Do you think it was meant for you? She shakes her head.
I was just telling Matthew that no one I know would have left me a note like that.
I look at the flowers in Matthew's hand, remembering the yellow roses that were sent anonymously to their home. You open and close the shop, right? Polly blinks, probably finding it curious that I know her schedule. So you left here at what, 6 p.m. yesterday?
Actually, last night.
Polly clears her throat and looks at Matthew.
I slept in the back room. Marissa knows there's a mouse problem at my house.
You spent the night here? I ask. Matthew doesn't appear shocked by this. Marissa must have explained Polly's situation to him.
Yeah, I went out and got dinner, then watched a movie on my laptop until about 11. I did a walk around right before I went to sleep because there's this mannequin head that was kind of creeping me out and I wanted to put a jacket over her.
She gives an embarrassed giggle.
And I know the note wasn't there then.
So it was delivered later last night or early this morning.
Look, it's obviously for Marissa.
Matthew's fist tightens as he crumples the paper, just as he crushed the plastic cup in my office during our first session.
That guy from the gym,
I interrupt. Have you told Marissa about the note? Matthew shakes his head and smooths out the note.
I could call her, Polly offers. Please hold off.
I touch Matthew's sleeve. Why don't we talk privately? Polly lingers, not taking the hint, and I'm struck by the thought that instead of being on the fringes of the bishop's life, as she should be, she's actually deeply entangled in it. As is Natalie. And perhaps others I don't yet know about. I lead Matthew outside the shop. We stand on the sidewalk, facing each other. Start from the beginning. Tell me what happened this morning. Matthew rocks back on his heels.
I had a breakfast meeting at our country club. It's just a few miles from the house. So I was driving to work later than usual, and when I stopped at a light, a guy was walking up and down the median strip, selling flowers from a bucket. Gotta be a rough job. So I bought a dozen. Figured I'd drop them off here, surprise Marissa.
I study his body language, but it tells me nothing. One of his hands is down at his side, and he's gesturing with the other.
Matthew claimed he'd forgotten that Marissa had a school meeting. Normally, at this time of day, she'd be just arriving here from the gym. I haven't run into her during any of my workouts, so I assume she's avoiding the place. But Matthew may not know that. Was he trying to spring a trap on his wife, appearing at her shop unannounced to see if she'd resumed her routine at Pinnacle?
When I rang the buzzer, no one answered. I started to unlock the door, I've got an extra key, thinking I'll leave the flowers on her desk. Then I see Polly coming toward me, and after she let me in, we both saw the note on the floor.
I stretch out my hand. May I have it? He frowns, but gives it to me. I study the message again. The words could lend themselves to different meanings. Romantic, passionate, committed. But given the circumstances, they feel ominous. Look, Matthew, even if this, I shake the paper, is from that guy, it doesn't mean that Marissa is still interested in him. The note actually implies the opposite.
Matthew nods. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, Marissa does seem like she wants to work things out. I can't see her stringing him along.
It's as if the crux of the bishop's problem, a seemingly straightforward infidelity, is growing tentacles that keep ensnaring new complications. There's a lot I need to do, fast. Talk to Polly one-on-one. Explore the exact nature of Matthew and Natalie's relationship. Confront Marissa with my near certainty that the man she slept with was not just some guy from the gym.
You told Polly not to say anything to Marissa. What are we supposed to do, just pretend this never happened? Because that's not going to work for me.
I hear a faint hitch in his voice. He sounds like a man who loves his wife and feels battered by emotions. It's a good thing the bishops came to me. There's no way they could have navigated this alone. I'm about to answer Matthew when I catch a glimpse of Marissa hurrying down the block. Her head is down as she taps on her phone, so I take a moment to study her. With her oversized dark sunglasses and the silky floral scarf tied off-center around her neck, she looks effortlessly stylish. She passes a homeless man on the corner, then lifts her chin. She stops in her tracks, her eyes widening as she spots Matthew and me. Then she continues walking at a slower pace until she reaches us. Perfect timing, I announce. Our fourth session begins now. The gentle beauty of the March morning feels incongruous to the tense mood enveloping the three of us as we walk in silence up Connecticut Avenue toward Chevy Chase Circle. The sun is warm and welcoming on my face, and the gentle breeze holds the smell of the hyacinths lining the window boxes of a cafe we pass. We reach the circle and carefully make our way through the crosswalk, entering the little plot of land straddling the line that divides D.C. and Maryland. The circle once held a majestic fountain that spouted water high into the air, but now it's broken, and just the concrete base remains, surrounded by azalea bushes and trees. Cars and trucks whip through the triple lanes that surround the little oasis. It's like being in the eye of a hurricane. Instead of sitting down on one of the benches, we remain standing in an asymmetrical triangle, facing one another. What's going on? Marissa asks. I hand the note to Marissa with the briefest of explanations. This was slid under the door of your shop sometime between 11 p.m. and 9:30 a.m.
I take in her expression as she reads it. Shock, and then dread.
Matthew.
She swallows hard, and her fingertips begin to play with the scarf around her neck.
I don't know what to say.
So you assume this is for you and not Polly? I ask. Marissa flinches.
It could have been, of course, but Polly isn't dating anyone, and she hasn't ever mentioned a man pursuing her.
Her rationale for her assumption is smooth and logical. But Marissa's reaction to the note was raw and unfiltered, and that told me more. She immediately knew it was meant for her, and not by a process of elimination. Marissa, you answered several important questions for me during our first session,
I say. If there's anything you haven't revealed, we need to know it right now. She shakes her head.
I swear, it was just that one time. It's over. I don't know why he won't...
She cuts herself off. Was she going to say, won't leave me alone? I wonder. Which begs the question, what else has he done?
Maybe it's over for you, but obviously not for him. Matthew interjects sharply. Read what he wrote. He's not letting you go.
Matthew, I begin.
Come on, Avery. With all due respect, look at the facts here. This guy knows where my wife works. He probably knows where we live. He could be dangerous.
He's not dangerous, Marissa interrupts.
How do you know that? He's just some random guy, right? I mean, how well could you really know him?
Matthew's tone is sincere. I wonder how long it'll be before he starts to suspect Marissa hasn't told us the entire truth.
If anyone is going to give my wife flowers, it's me.
Matthew's phone pings and he pulls it out of his pocket.
Fuck it. I'm late for a client meeting. He flew in from Switzerland. You know what would be almost as bad as losing you, Marissa? Losing my job. I gotta go.
Marissa wipes her eyes as Matthew retraces his steps back toward Coco. I study her as she stares after her husband. I've never seen Marissa like this. Her mascara is streaked and her face looks pale and a little hollow, as if she has dropped a few pounds she can't afford to lose. Are you ready to tell me what's really going on? I ask her. A puzzle I've been wrestling with is how the opportunity for infidelity presented itself to Marissa. The natural intersections in her life for her to meet men are few. Coco caters to women. And all but one of her vendors are all in other states or overseas. Her son's private school, where she's involved as a volunteer, hasn't any eligible candidates. No handsome soccer coach or intriguing male teacher. I've checked. Even the math tutor she just hired is female. Natalie mentioned some good-looking dads at Rolling Hills, but Marissa wouldn't risk entangling her son in something as sordid as a fling. Other than Marissa's boutique and Bennett's school, her present life revolves around Matthew. Which leads me to conclude that the man she slept with is almost certainly from her past. I wait for her to speak, but she just shudders and wraps her arms around herself. For most of my clients, the fourth session, revelation, means finally acknowledging lies. Either ones they've told themselves, or lies other people have convinced them to believe. Marissa's revelation, one that should hit her hard, is that she is betraying not only her husband, but herself and me by continuing to conceal the truth. That's something I won't stand for. Marissa, this isn't working, I say crisply. I'll send you a final bill for today. Good luck. I turn on my heel and walk away.
Chapter 16. Marissa. Marissa watches as Avery stands at the head of the crosswalk, waiting for a break in traffic to venture across the busy lanes of traffic and out of Marissa's life forever. Her head throbs and a wave of dizziness passes through her. Last night, she woke abruptly at 3 a.m. and lay there until dawn, while Matthew slept beside her, unaware. She nibbled on a half piece of dry toast this morning and drank too much coffee. Her secret is a rough, tight knot in her stomach. She can't continue like this. Wait, she calls out. Avery doesn't turn around. Avery, please. Maybe it's the tone of Marissa's pain-filled cry that captures Avery's sympathy, because she pulls back the foot she was about to plant in the street. Avery twists to face Marissa and studies her for a moment, then walks back. It wasn't a man from the gym. That guy doesn't exist, Marissa blurts. Avery nods. He's from your past, right? Someone you met at college or maybe your hometown. The color drains from Marissa's face. How did you... Matthew knows him too. Avery says this as a statement, not a question. Marissa wraps her arms around her waist and begins to shiver.
Yes,
she whispers. We've known each other forever. Avery exhales. You should have told me. We've wasted so much time working under a false pretense.
I'm sorry. Please, you have to help me. I'll do anything to fix this.
What else have you lied about? Avery asks abruptly. Did you sleep with him more than once? Maybe it went on for a couple weeks or longer?
No,
Marissa cries. She feels as if she were on the witness stand being cross-examined. And she's guilty. She knows she is, but only of that single infidelity. He's always had a thing for you. You like the attention. Maybe you led him on, flirted behind Matthew's back. But now he's hooked on you, and he's a problem that won't go away. Nausea fills Marissa's throat. How can Avery know so much? Marissa had liked the attention, but she never flirted, either in or out of Matthew's presence. And not because she didn't have the opportunity. The man she'd cheated with had been woven through most of their lives. When she was just a kid, he'd taught her to body surf the waves. They'd shared beers on sandy blankets, and he and Matthew used to race each other out to the floating dock. On her wedding day, he'd worn a tuxedo and stood beside the other men, and when Bennett was born, he sent a gigantic stuffed dog from FAO Schwartz. She has sat across from him at dinners dozens of times, and yes, she has looked up and caught his longing eyes lingering on her face. And just weeks ago, on the night this sordid mess all began, he phoned to say he was in the neighborhood, and a few minutes later she opened her front door to see him standing on her stoop with a wide grin and a bottle of Malbec tucked under his arm. He wasn't ever my boyfriend, Marissa tells Avery now, but he was my first kiss. His lips had felt warm and soft on hers. She'd caught the scent of the wintergreen lifesavers he'd always loved before she drew away. It was over in a moment, yet it felt as if it had the potential to change everything. But then Tina had been killed and the whole world seemed to turn upside down. It didn't take long for their high school English teacher to be arrested. Everyone agreed, after the fact, that he'd always been creepy. And afterward, the connection Marissa had felt seemed to evaporate.
If Matthew finds out, it will kill him.
Marissa can hardly bear to say the words aloud.
I'm not hiding it just to save my marriage. It's to protect Matthew. How could he ever recover from that?
A screeching noise erupts, and both women whirl around in time to see a small brown car narrowly avoid rear-ending a delivery van. This circle is a nightmare, Avery observes. Accidents happen here all the time. Marissa reaches for the arm of a bench and eases herself down. She's so lightheaded she could faint. Avery knows everything now, and there's no predicting what she'll do. She could call Matthew at this very moment and blurt it out. Matthew wouldn't come home tonight or ever again. He'd divorce her. Marissa feels certain of that. Here's what we'll do, Avery finally says, and Marissa holds her breath. You can keep this one secret for now, but this, Avery points to the note still in Marissa's hand, has to stop. Tell him you need to see him.
Won't that only encourage him?
It will be a brief meeting. He'll get the message loud and clear. Marissa briefly closes her eyes as her body sags in relief.
Thank you.
Text him now. One line. Can we meet today? Marissa pulls her phone from her purse and types the message. Almost immediately, three dots appear on her screen.
He's texting back.
She waits, holding her breath, then reads the reply.
I'm in LA all week, house Friday night or anytime over the weekend. I'll clear my schedule.
Clear my schedule? Avery repeats, shaking her head. He really does have it bad for you. Obviously, you're not going to meet him over the weekend because you'll be focused on your husband. Text him back and tell him you'll see him at noon on Monday at the coffee shop down the street from your store. Marissa frowns, her hand hovering over her phone. What? Avery prompts.
It's just that he's in California. But I guess he must have pushed that note under my door before he left.
Probably on his way to the airport early this morning.
Noon on Monday at Java Nation, Marissa repeats as she types the message.
The appointment feels like both a reprieve, because it's almost a full week away, and a punishment. Between now and then, do not reply to any texts he sends. Do not answer the phone if he calls. Marissa nods. Put him completely out of your mind, and let me know if he does try to contact you.
But what am I going to say when I see him?
That's what you've hired me for. Marissa has barely stepped inside Coco when Polly rushes to her side, bombarding her with rapid-fire questions.
Who would have left that note? Should we keep the door locked during the day? Do you think it's safe for me to sleep here?
Marissa massages her temples. I have no idea. I don't think it's necessary. That's up to you.
It was the craziest thing.
Polly puts a hand to her chest as Marissa begins to walk away.
I heard the buzzer, and even though it was a little early, I went to open the door. Right after I saw Matthew through the glass, I noticed the piece of paper. Matthew almost stepped on it when I let him in.
The anonymous note is clearly the most exciting thing that has happened to Polly in a while. Her cheeks are flushed and her eyes are bright. The throbbing in Marissa's head worsens.
I put Matthew's flowers in a vase,
Polly calls unnecessarily, as Marissa has already hurried into the back room and spotted the roses. Their sickly sweet smell permeates the small area. Marissa appreciates Matthew's gesture, but the flowers look a little wilted and brown around the edges. They're not nearly as lush as the bouquet she received just a few days ago. Her hand shakes as she uses a box cutter to slice open UPS packages and takes out cotton sweaters that just arrived from Santa Monica. She'd ordered them weeks ago, thinking their bright stripes would be perfect for spring. But now the jaunty colors seem garish, and she wonders if her judgment is off.
Do you want some tea?
Marissa starts at the sound of Polly's voice. I'm fine. Marissa doesn't glance up. Why can't Polly take a hint? Marissa's phone pings and she snatches it out of her purse. She'd texted Matthew as she retraced her steps from the Chevy Chase Circle back to Coco. Hope your day goes well. I love you. It's just an email from Natalie. In the hour or so since the conclusion of this morning's auction meeting, Natalie has already sent along the minutes and created a spreadsheet with action tasks assigned to each committee member. Marissa is supposed to ask her vendors to donate additional goods for the event, even though the school already has more than 150 pieces for the silent bidding. This is Natalie's first time on the benefit committee, and she has made it clear that she wants to set a record for profits. Marissa closes the email without reading it through to the end. Marissa is searching for a missing invoice for her accountant and fighting the urge to check her phone again when Polly pokes her head into the room.
You sure I can't pick you up a salad or a sandwich?
No, thank you, Marissa replies in a tight voice.
Well, if you need anything, I'm just up front. I'm going to start wrapping the bridesmaids' gifts for the Webster wedding.
Marissa can sense Polly's presence. Her young assistant is hovering in the doorway.
I was just thinking about that message. It's so creepy. Should we call the police?
No. Marissa's tone is knife sharp. She spins around to face Polly. Actually, Polly, I do need something. Polly's face lights up. I need you to answer a question for me. Why did you show that note to Matthew?
Like I said, he was right there when I saw it.
Marissa cuts her off. There's no reply Polly can give that will better the situation. If Polly were a different sort of person, thoroughly professional and discreet, Matthew might not ever have known about the note. Her husband is smart. He could very well be working his way to the same conclusion Avery already reached about the sender. You have no idea what you've done. Marissa's voice catches on her last word.
I'm so sorry, Marissa, but I...
Polly's lower lip is trembling and her eyes shine with tears. Marissa can't manage Polly's feelings now. She can't even be around her for another minute. The intrusions, the borrowed earrings, the mimicry, it's too much. Why don't you leave for the day? Marissa snaps. Actually, don't come in for the rest of the week. I'll pay you for your usual hours.
What?
Polly looks utterly stricken. I think you should take some time off. Polly begins to babble.
I didn't mean to.
Thankfully, Marissa's ringing phone cuts her off. It's a client who wants to place a special order. Hold on just one second and let me get to my computer, Marissa says into the phone. She mutes the call. Polly, I'll be in touch soon. Before Polly can say another word, Marissa turns all of her attention back to her caller. The first few hours without Polly are like a holiday. Only two customers stop by, so Marissa has the luxury of sipping tea and straightening every last shelf, drawer, and surface in her shop. She hadn't realized how pervasive Polly's presence was in the shop, how watched Marissa felt. Alone with her thoughts, she begins to formulate what she'll say to Matthew tonight. She'll suggest another date night this weekend so they don't lose the progress they've made. But the moment Marissa checks the calendar on her computer, her hard-fought peace vanishes. Matthew's overseas client will be here all week, and Matthew will be working late every night. Bennett has a baseball game at 3 today that Marissa planned to attend. Plus, she has a dental checkup on Thursday, and there's another auction meeting Friday morning. The only options Marissa has are to cancel everything, to shut down the shop while she's away, or apologize to Polly and ask her to come back. Marissa looks around her tranquil, gorgeous store. She's tempted to hang a little sign on her door explaining the hours have been adjusted, but that's a guaranteed way to upset customers. She needs Polly here this week. Marissa will blame her irritability on the events of the past few days. Polly will probably understand. The pregnancy disappointment, Marissa's lack of sleep, the ominous note. But Marissa will simultaneously step up her search for a permanent replacement. She has already reached out to a few friends to see if they know anyone who might be looking, but she hasn't received any promising replies. Marissa takes a moment to craft an email to the Career Placement Center of George Washington University, asking if she can post a listing. Then she dials Polly's number. It goes straight to voicemail.
Hi, this is Polly. I'm out and about, but if you leave your number, I'll give you a shout.
Even Polly's rhyming message irritates Marissa, but she simply asks Polly to please call her back as soon as possible. Marissa helps a young man choose a cashmere blanket for his girlfriend, and a woman on her lunch break select gorgeous bookends for her secretary. Even though the woman shops at Coco every few weeks, Marissa can't recall her name. If Polly were there, she'd prompt Marissa. Polly made it a point to learn all of the details about their frequent customers. Ringing the woman up, Marissa glances at the name on the credit card.
Bye, Carol,
Marissa calls out as her customer exits the store. Then Marissa dials Polly again. Still no answer. This time, Marissa doesn't leave a message. Marissa glances at her watch. Bennett's game is at St. Albans Field. She wants to send Matthew pictures of their son playing, not only because he'd love to see them, but also as a reminder of all they've built together. But she can't man the store and attend the game. Polly still hasn't phoned back, and Matthew hasn't texted. Marissa reaches for her laptop computer and searches her email files until she finds the resume Polly submitted when she applied for the job. She lives near American University, just off Massachusetts Avenue. The cursor blinks on Marissa's computer screen as she calculates time and distance, mentally reorganizing her afternoon. Polly probably went home, even given the rodent issue. She'd mentioned to Marissa that she would be stopping by her house every day to shower and grab a change of clothes. Perhaps she's in the shower now, which is why she isn't answering her phone. If Marissa closes Coco and leaves immediately, she could get to Polly's, convince her assistant to come back, and still make it to the field in time for the second inning. She removes her coat from the hook inside her office, flips the store's open sign to closed, and types the address into Google Maps. It's a 17-minute drive, according to the app. Marissa makes it in 15. She pulls up to the curb outside the small brick rancher and looks at the house. Polly is a major player in Marissa's world, but this is the first time Marissa has entered Polly's orbit. It's a pleasant-looking place. The yard has recently been mowed, and though the home is modest, the screened-in porch must be nice to sit in during the bug-filled summer evenings. Marissa hurries up the front walk and presses the doorbell. She can hear music playing inside, the folksy jangle of the Grateful Dead. Then an unfamiliar female voice calls, "Who is it?" "I'm looking for Polly Walker. Is she here?" The door opens, revealing a young woman with frizzy brown hair and glasses.
"Sorry, who are you?"
"Marissa Bishop." Clearly, the housemate has no idea who Marissa is. "Polly works for me." The woman pushes her glasses up on her nose as she examines Marissa more closely.
"Oh, right, at the real estate company?" Anyway, she's not here. Sorry. Behind her, Marissa can hear laughter, and then a male voice shouts,
Is it the pizza guy?
Nah, someone for Polly, the woman calls back. Then she turns back to Marissa. Maybe she's in class? Had Polly once mentioned she was taking a design course? Marissa can't remember. She knows so little about her assistant. She didn't even remember Polly once had a job in real estate, even though she has asked Polly about her life from time to time. But Polly, so seemingly artless in some ways, is adept at always turning the conversation back to Marissa. Please tell her I stopped by and would love for her to call. And if the exterminator isn't finished, she can stay at the store tonight. Exterminator? The words die in Marissa's throat before she can utter them. For the mouse problem. There is no mouse problem, she realizes with a start. Polly fabricated that story. The question filling Marissa's mind is, why?
Chapter 17. Avery. So, how are you holding up? My primary care physician, Dr. Hernandez, fixes me with warm brown eyes. I've been seeing her for years, since I was in grad school. She guided me through a cancer scare, the lump in my breast was benign, as well as my thyroid issue, and has seen me transform from a single woman to a married one to a widow. Now I sit in her private office, with a view of the Potomac River and a vase of irises on her uncluttered desk, for my annual wellness visit. Dr. Hernandez is in her early 60s and wears a slim gold band on her ring finger. A photograph of her with her wife is on her desk, and I sometimes wonder if her life is as serene and well-ordered as it appears. Pretty well, I say. Are you still taking the trazodone? Do you need a refill? I'm okay. The truth is, I never even picked up the prescription she gave me shortly after Paul's death. I know Dr. Hernandez meant well when she suggested the antidepressant. It'll help with your sleep and anxiety. Like everyone else, my doctor assumed Paul's death would upend my world. And it did, but not in the way she anticipated. My feelings about Paul are complicated, though their jagged edges have softened with time. I am grateful I never told Paul I was planning to move out, so I could at least spare him that emotional pain, even if I couldn't rid him of his physical suffering. And I will never regret caring for him during those final months. Before Paul got sick, I'd drafted a different ending for us. I assumed that after the bumpiness of our divorce, we'd become friends. I didn't know if either of us would remarry, but we'd always be linked by our years together and through our love for Lana. I could see us consulting on patients and perhaps sharing holiday dinners now and then. But we don't always get to write our own stories. Paul was robbed of his second act. But I can't deny that I'm enjoying mine. Maybe it sounds selfish, but I sleep better these days, alone in my bed, than I ever did by Paul's side, even before he got sick. The vibe in my house is no longer dictated by his mercurial moods. Most of all, I find relief in not having to be accountable to anyone. I can book a client for any hour, get a massage during dinner time, spontaneously meet a friend at 8 o'clock p.m. for cocktails, then stay out even later if I meet someone interesting. When my husband died, my life opened up. It isn't the right thing to say, which is one of the reasons why I've never said it to anyone. I actually haven't been taking it, I tell Dr. Hernandez. I adopted this dog, Romeo, and that's really helped. The extra exercise and companionship. My implication is that I adopted Romeo shortly after Paul's death, rather than just last week. I don't enjoy misleading Dr. Hernandez, but it's easier this way. Okay. How are you eating? Pretty well. I'm not getting my 7 servings of fruits and veggies a day, or whatever they recommend, but who really does that? She smiles. It's 9. Just do the best you can.
What about drinking? How many units of alcohol would you say you consume per week? 5 or 6. I watch as she types the information into her laptop. Actually, it's probably more like 10 or so. Does everyone undercount when they come in here? You should probably just double whatever people say to be safe. This gets her to laugh. And before you ask, yes, I occasionally smoke a joint or take a gummy, but that's it, no hard drugs. A little pot won't hurt, as long as it's not too often. She finishes typing and looks up at me. Anything else you want to discuss? This is the part I've been dreading. Yeah, when you're running my blood work, would you mind just adding on a test for any STDs? I force myself to look Dr. Hernandez in the eye as I fib. There was this one guy. I'm not going to tell Dr. Hernandez I've been with a few men since Paul died. People feel comfortable with the image of a grieving widow. They're far less generous when someone strays from the confines of that perception. Avery, this is a doctor's office, not a courtroom. She puts a hand on my shoulder. As long as you're taking care of yourself, I'm not here to judge. Not for the first time. I'm struck by the thought that I could be friends with Dr. Hernandez under other circumstances. After the physical exam, I check out at the front desk, then step out of her office and walk down the short corridor to the elevator and press the call button. It's late morning, and though several other medical professionals occupy space on this floor, I'm the only one waiting. I pull out my phone to check my email, still looking down at my screen when the elevator arrives. I step inside and press P3, then type a response to a client who wants to switch her appointment time later this week. Just as the doors begin to close, a man's arm shoots through them, forcing them back open. I hadn't even noticed him in the narrow hallway. I tuck my phone back into my purse and step aside to let him choose his floor. He avoids eye contact with me and doesn't even seem to glance at the button panel. Instead, he merely moves to the far corner. There's a 25% chance we could have parked on the same level, since the lot only has 4. Still, I shift my body so I can see him in my peripheral vision. He's wearing a suit and tie with an overcoat, but he doesn't carry a briefcase. Something is off. He's staring at me now. It all happens so quickly that before I can act, the doors close, sealing the two of us together. I mentally kick myself. Like many women, I've placed my desire to be polite ahead of my need to protect myself. I should simply have stepped out of the elevator and waited for the next one. My body prepares for a threat. I edge forward until my hand is by the control panel. If he tries anything, instead of pressing emergency stop, which would trap me, I plan to push the buttons for every single floor, as well as the one labeled emergency call. We reach P3 and the doors slide open. I exhale the breath I've been holding. The man waits to exit until I step out. Many guys do this. It's considered gentlemanly. Still, I don't like having him behind me again. It's a bright day outside, but the underground lot is dim and shadowy. The parking attendant who'd handed me my ticket on the way in is several stories above us, well out of earshot. I walk toward my BMW, adrenaline thrumming through my body. In the distance, I can see there aren't any other vehicles parked near mine, so the man should be heading in a different direction. But unless I turn around, it's impossible to tell. The tapping of my heels on the cement is amplified in the subterranean lot, and I can't hear any other noises. Right before I reach my car, I steal a look behind me and my pulse explodes. He's just a few feet away. He has been keeping pace with me this whole time. That crisp, expensive-looking suit and his blank gaze, they unnerve me. This man is targeting me. I'm done being polite. I whip around to face him. "Can I help you?" I ask, aiming for the fiercest tone I can muster. His voice is so low I can barely make out his words. "Just give us the name." He's from Acelia. They still think I might give Finley up.
but I never will. I fumble in my purse for my fob, chastising myself for not having it out earlier, keeping my eyes glued on the man. He could be carrying a gun, its shape concealed by his overcoat.
You volunteered information. Who told you?
My hand gropes inside my purse again, feeling my wallet and makeup bag and phone, and finally the hard metal edge of the can of mace attached to my keychain.
It can be very simple, or you can make it complicated.
Adrenaline floods my limbs. If he is going to come after me, he'll do it now. I have a plan for that, too. I'll blast him in the face with mace, then hit the alarm button on my fob. I'll go down fighting. There's no way I'll let him abduct me from my own car. I suck in a shallow breath, my body tense. He remains immobile.
We won't stop, and it can get much worse.
I back up until I feel the edge of my fender. Then in one furious, fluid motion, I unlock the driver's side door, slide inside, and instantly lock it again. He stares at me through my window, still expressionless. But he hasn't made a move toward me. I reverse out of the parking space, nearing sideswiping him, then speed up the circular ramps. When I reach the attendant, I'm about to tell him about the strange man. But what crime can I report the guy for? Getting on an elevator with me and riding it to the same level? It takes a while for my body to unclench. The thought of going home and curling up with Romeo is tempting, but I've got a full day, and I'm not going to let Acelia steal it from me. As I wind my way through the streets of D.C., heading toward Maryland and the cafe I want to scope out before Marissa's meeting with her ex-lover, a thought strikes me. How did that man know where to find me today? Is there a tracker on my car? Could they have hacked my computer? A wave of dizziness engulfs me and I pull over to the side of the road. I flick on my hazard lights and crack my windows to let in the cold, bracing air. It's afternoon and I haven't eaten anything today or even had coffee, standard procedure before an annual physical, which is making it difficult to think clearly. Perhaps they simply followed me here, I think. It takes me a moment to come up with another possibility. The words Dr. Hernandez and 10 a.m. were in the appointment book I keep on my desk, the book with the striped ribbon. The one I'm now certain Skip checked out when he came to my place on Friday night.
Chapter 18. Marissa. Marissa watches the spinning, dipping baseball arc into center field, then bounce roughly against the grass. She breathes a sigh of relief as Bennett scoops it up. It's the bottom of the second inning, but neither team has yet scored, and she got here in time to see Bennett make a good play. Matthew hasn't replied to her text. Marissa had to shut down Coco for the afternoon, and she has no idea what to do about Polly. But at least this one thing is right in her world. She continues walking toward the bleachers, waving at a cluster of parents, as she watches her son twist and hurl the ball to second base, his aim straight and true. Her heart gives a little leap. Bennett is really improving in baseball. "Good job," she calls, starting to applaud. Then she stops. The thin, light-haired boy who made the play isn't her son. Maybe Coach Santo put Bennett in a different position, she thinks. Marissa missed last week's game, but Bennett told her he'd played well. She peers into the distance, trying to make out each player's face. It's hard to tell who's beneath the identical red baseball caps, but she finally spots Bennett. He's hunched on the dugout bench next to a boy with a cast on his arm.
Marissa!
She lifts her head at the sound of her name. It takes a moment for her to place the mom who waves her over. It's Carrie, whose son Lance plays first base and opts to wear his older sister's hand-me-down pink cleats, a detail that endears him to Marissa.
Come sit. Oh, I love your jacket.
Carrie gives Marissa a quick, hard hug. Her warmth takes Marissa by surprise. Marissa unexpectedly feels on the verge of tears and is grateful for her sunglasses. Marissa hasn't made any close friends at the school, but she has always had the impression that Carrie is funny and kind. Marissa has a faint recollection of Carrie's once suggesting they grab lunch. Marissa never followed up on it, though. It feels like another in a long list of her mistakes. It's good to see you, Marissa says, squeezing into the crowded row. Carrie has a big snack bag between her feet, with sliced oranges and a giant Ziploc and individual packets of trail mix studded with pretzels, raisins, and bright M&Ms. Marissa's stomach growls, and she realizes she has barely eaten today.
Is Bennett okay? Carrie asks.
A player from the opposing team hits a pop fly, and the pitcher makes a diving catch, ending the inning. The parents applaud. One man, who Marissa surmises is the pitcher's father, stomps his feet against the bleachers, and the players run in to end the inning.
I thought so, Marissa tells Carrie. Maybe I should go check.
A woman seated in front of them turns around, her glossy blonde ponytail swinging against her shoulder. She frowns, but no creases form in her perfect skin.
I wasn't here last week, but Jacob says he didn't play then either.
Hi, Dawn, Marissa says, trying to keep the resignation from her tone. Dawn is also on the auction committee. Marissa sat across from her at this morning's meeting, and she seems to be one of Natalie's many hangers-on. Marissa turns to Carrie.
Is that true? Did Bennett sit out last week?
Dawn stays twisted around, clearly more interested in the scene behind her than the one playing out on the field.
I think so, Carrie says softly, ducking her head.
Marissa's stomach clenches as she recalls the conversation with Bennett after his last game.
I got on base twice, he'd said, and Matthew had congratulated him and tousled his hair. Why would Bennett lie?
Is he being bullied again? Or is Coach Santo punishing Bennett because he did something wrong? With Dawn's gaze fixed upon her, Marissa tries to hide her distress.
I'm sure it's no big deal, Carrie says, patting Marissa gently on the knee. He probably just isn't feeling well. I think a little bug is going around.
Yeah, that's probably it, Marissa says, grateful for the excuse Carrie has lobbed her. For the rest of the game, Marissa tries to catch Bennett's eye, but he's so focused on the field that he never turns around. Or at least he's pretending to be. She's so tense that when her cell phone gently buzzes with a text, Marissa flinches as if the sound were a gunshot. She hopes it's from Matthew, but she doesn't want to pull out her phone here with the other parents so close by in case the message is from the wrong man. She cheers along with the crowd when Lance hits a triple, and she groans softly when another boy overthrows the ball to the catcher, letting in a run, but her reactions are a beat off, and her mind is consumed by what she should do when the game ends. She'll talk to Bennett first, then call Coach Santo tonight or tomorrow, she decides. Bennett isn't a natural athlete, something all the private coaching and encouragement in the world can't make up for. But he possesses something more rare and, in Marissa's eyes, far more valuable. Once, during a baseball game, a player on Bennett's team hit a grand slam during the final inning, winning the game. While all the other boys on his team ran toward each other, whooping, Bennett walked up to the pitcher of the opposing team, who was crying, and tried to comfort him. Bennett's tender heart is perhaps his greatest gift. Now, as Marissa stares at her son's thin shoulders and slightly bowed head, hers aches for him. She helps Bennett collect his things after the game. Then, as they walk to the car, Bennett crouches down and peers into the grass.
What is it?
Bennett points.
A honeybee.
Oh, I see it now. Marissa carefully steps over it. Bennett remains in a squat, watching the insect.
Come on, sweetie.
The temperature has dipped in concert with the sun, and she's eager to talk to Bennett.
It shouldn't be out here alone.
What do you mean?
Honeybees cluster around the queen in their hives in the cold weather. That way they stay warm.
Why do you think this one is out? Bennett shakes his head.
He must be confused. He left the hive too early.
Maybe if we leave him here, he'll find his way back. Bennett looks around at the wide open grounds, clearly taking in that no beehive is nearby.
Do you want to bring him home with us?
Marissa doesn't like insects, but she could use her portable coffee mug to contain it if that's what it takes. Bennett merely stands up.
No, I think we should leave him. He doesn't belong inside.
Bennett sighs heavily, and Marissa wraps an arm around him as they continue walking. At the car, Marissa pops the trunk so he can put his baseball bag and backpack away. He buckles himself into the back seat. He still uses a booster since he's small for his age. And Marissa turns off the radio, giving Bennett a chance to start the conversation. As she winds through the streets toward home, she keeps glancing in the rearview mirror at Bennett, who is picking around the raisins from his bag of trail mix to get at the pretzels and M&Ms. He has taken off his baseball cap, and his hair is sticking up in the back. A parenting book Marissa once read suggested a car ride as an ideal time to have difficult talks with boys, claiming that they feel less vulnerable opening up when they can avoid direct eye contact. She asks as casually as she can, "So, you want to tell me why you didn't play today, sweetie?"
"My stomach hurt."
Bennett pops another M&M in his mouth. "Seems like it's better now," she replies gently as she turns onto Wisconsin Avenue.
Yeah.
"And last week?" Bennett doesn't answer.
"Jacob's mom says you didn't play then either. I hope the honeybee is okay."
"I hope so too." Marissa lets the baseball games drop for now. When they get home, Bennett runs up to his room to feed Sam, his gecko. He desperately wants a dog, but Matthew is allergic, so the little green creature is the only pet in the house. Marissa takes tortillas, a bell pepper, cheddar cheese, and cooked chicken out of the refrigerator to assemble quesadillas, then pulls out her phone. She has three texts. The first is from her mom, who has recently discovered emojis, and its four lines are filled with hearts, kisses, flowers, and a random broccoli floret. The next is from Polly, asking if they can talk. And the third comes from Matthew, telling her that he'll be out late with his client. The reply to her mother is easy. Marissa shoots back a row of hearts. Polly is more complicated. Marissa finally suggests a coffee before the store opens tomorrow. Now that Marissa is no longer going to Pinnacle, her mornings have more give. Polly responds immediately.
"Of course, see you then."
Marissa considers asking Polly if she is sleeping at the store again, but decides to let it go. The last thing Marissa wants is to spark a long exchange. Marissa turns her attention back to the most important message, Matthew's, trying to glean the subtext. He didn't respond that he loved her too, but neither was he curt, and he did write, "Sorry, babe." She thinks about telling him she'll wait up for him, or asking him to check in with Bennett, who has migrated to the family room. But in the end, she simply writes, "Okay, good luck." Marissa sets down her phone and pours herself a glass of Sancerre. She closes her eyes and takes a sip, thinking that the first taste of morning coffee and the first one of evening wine have to rank up there with the world's greatest pleasures. She unwraps the block of cheese and begins to grate it. Her chest feels tight, and she tries to match her inhalations and exhalations to the back and forth motion of her hand. She has almost filled the small bowl when Bennett shrieks,
"Mom!"
Marissa's knuckle scrapes against the grater.
"Shit,"
she mutters. A tiny drop of blood is on her finger, but at least Bennett isn't there to remind her about the curse jar.
"Mom!" Bennett yells again. "I can't find my Cub Scout rope."
Cub Scout rope? She has no idea what he's talking about. Then it comes to her. At the last meeting, all the cubs were sent home with a white, foot-long length of rope to practice their knots.
"Isn't it in one of the baskets by the TV?"
Marissa calls back. She remembers Bennett attempting to tie square knots in the family room, chewing on the inside of his cheek the way he always does when he is concentrating. Even now, she can still hear the instructions he'd memorized. Loop on top, rabbit runs up through the hole, back around the tree, down the hole again.
"No, I looked! Sweetie, I'm making dinner, so I need it now!"
Bennett's voice hitches. Marissa hurries into the family room and sees Bennett sitting in the middle of the rug, all of his toy bins emptied around him.
"It isn't anywhere!"
Bennett is on the verge of tears. Marissa sinks to her knees and sorts through the puzzles, Marvel action figures, Star Wars lightsabers, and board games. She and Bennett peer under the chairs and the couch that Marissa deliberately stained. They even remove all of the cushions. But the rope is nowhere. Finally, Marissa says, "We'll have to get another one."
"But my test is tomorrow."
Bennett begins to cry, his face reddening.
"Honey."
Bennett's wail drowns her out. He throws a Harry Potter wand across the room, barely missing a lamp.
"Bennett!"
Marissa can't recall her mild-mannered son having a tantrum like this since he was a toddler and grew overtired at the Sesame Place theme park. She reaches over and enfolds him in her arms, feeling his body shudder with sobs.
"I was supposed to be practicing. I'm going to fail."
"Oh, sweetie, it's okay." She repeats the words as she rocks her son, attempting to soothe herself along with Bennett. She has tried so hard to conceal from her son the turbulent emotions she has been feeling, but clearly he's absorbing some of the stress swirling inside their home. She wishes Matthew were here to join in their hug and then maybe run out to Home Depot to pick up another rope. But Matthew will hardly see Bennett this week. Marissa will be the one to take Bennett to Cub Scouts again, and while some moms are always at the meetings and events, most of the boys are there with their fathers. Bennett has never complained about this. Still, Marissa wonders if it could be contributing to his pain. Matthew made it to the Pinewood Derby last year, but it was the Scoutmaster who'd helped Bennett build his little wooden race car. Matthew simply doesn't have the time to take Bennett to Nationals games or nature centers or attend every school conference. Bennett must be missing a feeling of connection to Matthew, too. Maybe fractures exist not only in her marriage, but in their family. Instead of trying to put on a happy facade, the equivalent of a curated Instagram post, she should be more real with her son. That's what Avery would recommend. "I've been a little stressed lately, too. You know how sometimes you and Charlie get into arguments and then you make up?" Bennett nods.
"Yeah, like when he tried to feed Sam a Fruit Loop, which could have been really dangerous."
"Yes, well, Dad and I have been arguing a little, but we're doing better now." Bennett grows perfectly still, and Marissa wonders for a moment whether she's made a mistake. Maybe this is too much information. Then, in a small voice, Bennett asks,
"Is that why he was sleeping in the elephant room?"
It's Bennett's nickname for the guest room, which has a big painting of a majestic elephant on the wall.
"Yes." "Are you going to get divorced like Olivia's parents?"
"Of course not. Daddy and I love each other very much, and we both really love you." Marissa remains on the floor, holding her son, knowing that despite everything else demanding her attention, nothing matters more than this. Bennett sniffs.
"Okay, then can you tell Dad I don't want to play baseball?"
"You don't want to play baseball?" Bennett has played since Matthew signed him up for a T-ball league when he was 5. He complained about going to practice sometimes, but Marissa assumed he had a good time when he got there. Bennett shakes his head.
"It isn't fun."
"If you don't like baseball, you don't have to play baseball," she finally says. "I'm sure Dad will understand." She knows Matthew won't be happy about it, though. He lettered in 3 sports in high school and played club ice hockey and baseball in college. It's only natural that he hoped their son would inherit that physical prowess and enjoy being on teams. But Bennett isn't built that way, emotionally or physically. He's his own person. And he's certainly intuitive enough to know that Matthew will be disappointed. Marissa hugs her son tighter.
"I have an idea.
How about we order pizza for dinner? Then maybe I can find something else for you to practice knots with." Bennett squeezes her back, his thin arms locked around her waist, then lets go.
"I love you. Love you more."
She kisses the top of his head. "Should we go pick toppings? You want pineapple and anchovies, right?"
"Ew!"
Bennett pretends to throw up, then gets to his feet. As he and Marissa walk back into the kitchen, Marissa spots the Transformers watch that Bennett left on the end table next to the sofa. She hesitates. Something about the way the fabric wristband is splayed across the wood table jars her memory, and it hits her. That's the exact spot where she last saw the Cub Scout rope, on the night when Matthew was in New York and her life began to unravel.
Mom?
Bennett calls, and Marissa is reminded that she has also betrayed her son. Bennett is already sitting on his favorite stool at the Granite Island, clicking away on Marissa's laptop. It's a little frightening how adept he is with technology, and has called up the website for his favorite pizza place. Marissa steps into the kitchen, expecting him to ask what size pie he should select or whether he can get a Sprite with dinner. She's prepared to give him anything he wants. But the question that comes from her son surprises and saddens her. It will reverberate through her mind the rest of the evening, fighting her attempts to sleep until, finally, at a little after 11 p.m., she takes a Xanax to quiet her brain. Bennett asks,
"If you and Dad do get divorced, can I live only with you?"
Chapter 19. Avery. The faint odor of cooked meat hits me when I walk into my house as if someone is eating a hamburger in my kitchen. I stand motionless in the doorway, my eyes roaming over the items littering the hallway and living room, torn paper towels, eggshells, an empty carton of Greek yogurt, and a mushy, speckled brown banana peel I threw away yesterday. For a split second, I worry someone has broken in again. Then I identify the culprit. Romeo stares up at me, his tail thumping against the wood floor, part of the grease-stained Five Guys foil wrapper from last night's takeout stuck to his plastic cone. "Are you kidding me?" His tail wraps harder as I sigh and begin to clean up. In the kitchen, I discover the built-in drawer holding my trash and recycling bins is wide open. Either I forgot to shut it tightly or my dog has figured out how to open it. "My little dumpster diver, you were doing so well out of the crate. What happened?" I scold Romeo as I wipe down the floor. He licks my hand and looks suitably ashamed. I have no idea what he is digesting, and I don't want another unwelcome surprise from him, so I change into my workout clothes, clip on his leash, and take him for a long walk. It feels a bit like I'm rewarding Romeo's bad behavior, but I remember Skip's advice to go easy on him. I no longer trust Skip, but he did seem to have a way with my dog. Every few minutes, I spin around and check the street behind me, and I scrutinize the faces of people who pass me. I don't intend to let Acelia's henchmen catch me unawares again. When we get back to the house, I reset the alarm, then settle into work, keeping Romeo in my office with me. After paying a few bills, conducting a Zoom session with a client who had to unexpectedly leave town to care for her ill mother, and returning a few other calls, I turn my attention to drafting emails to send to Matthew and Marissa separately. Our next session is devastation. I need the bishops to be in a positive frame of mind when they come to see me on Thursday, because experiencing an abrupt drop in emotions, such as the dip in the roller coaster that comes after the slow climb, will strip away more of their superficial gloss. I craft my message to Marissa first, thinking about what I want to accomplish. When he learned of his wife's betrayal, Matthew's ego suffered a major blow. Marissa needs to offset some of that damage. I type this instruction. When you next see Matthew, bring up something that makes him a great husband. Be specific. Then I follow up with a message for Matthew. Marissa feels unseen in her marriage. This is one of the top reasons a woman will stray from her husband and why it's so important for Matthew to make a course correction. When I spoke to Matthew alone during our first session, I took him back to the early days of his relationship with Marissa in the hopes of recapturing some of those positive feelings. Given the bomb Marissa had just thrown into the room, it took a while for Matthew to be able to say anything positive about his wife. But when he did, it was such a stunning, raw declaration that I still find myself replaying it in my mind. The sentiment Matthew expressed is one of the reasons why I'm eager to help the bishops find their way back to each other. I send Matthew the following instruction. You told me the first time you kissed Marissa, it was like glimpsing the ocean for the first time. The next time you see her, tell her this. Before I can hit send, my cell phone rings and Lana's photo appears on my screen. We spoke earlier today while I was driving to Dr. Hernandez's office, so I'm surprised she's reaching out again. Hey, sweetie. Avery! Oh my God, my car! I just left work. I can't believe someone... Slow down. Are you hurt? Were you in an accident? No, no. She lets out a huffing sound. My tires! Someone let the air out of them, all four. They were that way when I got to my parking spot. Who would do that to me? I suspect I know exactly who. Acelia. The parallel is clear. Someone came after me in a parking garage today, and now they're messing with my sweet, guileless stepdaughter in a different parking lot. Fury courses through my body. Where are you now? I'm glad it's still daylight out. I'm right by my car. I tried my mom, but she didn't pick up. Greg's at work, so he can't talk. I'm glad you called me. I'm going to get in touch with AAA, and I'll come wait with you. Okay, thanks. I'll be here. I frown as I grab my purse and slip on my sneakers. I don't want her alone in a parking lot, even for a short time. Actually, is there somewhere else you can go? How about that sandwich shop you like? Why? I'm hungry, I lie. Order us two of those veggie things and I'll meet you there. An hour later, Lana's tires have been refilled and she's at Greg's place, where she plans to sleep tonight, and I'm driving home, clutching my steering wheel so tightly my knuckles are white. Skip must be the key to all of this. He knows I have a stepdaughter since Lana phoned once when he and I were together, and although I don't recall mentioning where she worked, he could probably find out. And who else would know about my doctor's visit? I never mentioned it to a soul. I'm tempted to call Skip and let loose, but I tamp down on that instinct. If Skip is weaving some complicated web, he's already several steps ahead of me, and acting impulsively is the worst thing I can do. I mentally review what I know about him. He's 40, never married, and a commercial real estate developer. He's the youngest of three, went to Dartmouth, and lived in California before moving to D.C. There's no obvious tie between him and Acelia. But I can't shake loose the idea that if I dig deeper, I will find one. Maybe it's time to call the police. I also know a former cop who now works as a private investigator. I used him on a case a couple months ago. I step harder on the gas, trying to catch the tail end of a yellow light. Part of the reason I'm so enraged is because I genuinely liked Skip. My instincts told me he was a decent guy, and I'm not usually so off base when it comes to sizing people up. He's making me feel like a fool. The light turns, and I slam on my brakes, the nose of my BMW edging into the intersection. A woman walking a white poodle glares at me as she maneuvers around my car. Get a grip, I order myself sternly, as I would a client. My front windshield begins to fog up, so I turn on the defrost and try to swipe away some of the cloudy film with my sleeve, but my thin Lycra top is ineffective. I reach into my center console glove compartment, where I usually keep a few paper napkins. I don't see any, but there's a pack of tissues. I pull one out and stare at it, remembering how Skylar plucked a tissue out of her handbag and offered it to me. I shake my head as I realize my mistake. I've been focusing on the wrong parallel. A car honk from behind me jolts me, and I shift my foot off the brake, driving more carefully now. What happened to Lana's car wasn't a message from Acelia to let me know they could get to my stepdaughter. Someone else was behind it. You know so much about me. I guess I wanted to learn more about you, Skylar had said. Cameron's ex must be the one who let the air out of Lana's tires. It seems like exactly the kind of spiteful act she would perpetrate. I turn down my street corner and park in front of my house, but I don't immediately cut off the engine.
My mind is operating clearly now that the muddy swirl of my emotions is falling away. I need to do two things, fast. Confirm Skylar did this to Lana, and find a way to make sure she never comes near my stepdaughter again. I consider a few options before I find the right one. The genesis for my idea is right there on my phone screen in a message Derek texted shortly before I left the house. Hey, babe, you free tonight? Job just canceled. Derek and I pull up outside Skylar's house in a suburban Silver Spring neighborhood shortly after 7 o'clock p.m. The modest, single-story brick structure is on a dead-end street filled with nearly identical houses. While the other homes have nice details, a rope swing hanging from a tree in one front yard and pretty landscaping in another, Skylar's place looks a little tired and worn since I was here last fall. The grass in her front yard is patchy, and it's the only house on the block with a garbage can languishing at the curb. Cameron used to tend to the lawn and lug the garbage bins up and down the driveway on trash day, along with everything else he did, such as the grocery shopping and cooking. Now that Skylar is living alone, it's on her to keep up with the household chores. Thanks again for doing this, I say as Derek opens the driver's side door of his van, the one with the name of his security company emblazoned on both sides. I slide into the back so I can peek out the tinted window. Derek climbs Skylar's stairs and rings the bell. He's in his work uniform, crisp dark slacks, a button-down shirt, and a jacket with his first name and his company's logo embroidered beneath his left shoulder. Skylar opens her door and peers out at Derek. I wonder if she's having the same reaction I did when Derek showed up on my doorstep, looking more like a Nike model than a tech guy. I can't hear them talking, but I know what Derek is saying. We crafted his lines together. He's reassuring Skylar that this isn't a sales call, and confiding that his company sent him to see her because she might have information about a crime. With his husky voice and warm eyes, I have no doubt that Skylar will be seduced into believing Derek. Skylar steps out of her house, joining Derek on the stoop. He gestures toward the truck, and she glances at it, nodding. Derek keeps talking, telling her that his company would prefer this conversation to be confidential, and I see her smile. He has that effect on people. She tosses her hair back and leans in closer to him, and I can't help thinking about a fish being reeled in. I can tell the moment he delivers the punchline. We have you on video, letting the air out of the tires of a silver Honda in the parking lot near the Uptown Theater. Skylar's hand flies to cover her mouth. Gotcha, I think. She shakes her head, trying to deny his words, but Derek keeps talking, telling her it's a misdemeanor and that the car's owner is considering whether to forward the video to the police, as well as suing for towing and court costs. Derek knows what to do next. He drills in, informing her that the vehicle's owner can and will legally disseminate copies of the recording to Skylar's neighbors, her boss, and everyone she is connected to on social media if Skylar ever goes near the car or its owner again. I see Skylar's body crumple into itself like a balloon deflating. A different video marked the beginning of my trouble with Skylar. Now this non-existent one. We'll end it. Derek walks away as Skylar stares after him. For a brief moment, I actually feel sorry for this lonely, miserable woman. Later that night, I lie in bed next to Derek. His muscular arm is draped over my bare stomach, his breath as warm and rhythmic against my neck as his body had been moments before. That was incredible, I say. I told you I'd make the visit worth your while. His fingertips stop tracing circles across my still sweaty skin, and I wonder if he's drifting off to sleep. I prop myself up on an elbow and catch a glimpse of the digital clock on his nightstand. Almost midnight. Time to get going. I climb out of his bed and reach for my lacy bra. You know, before tonight, I didn't even know you had a stepdaughter.
Oh, I reply, thinking, and she's about the same age as you. Derek has only been to my place twice. During our initial meeting, when he installed motion detectors and glass break sensors and a couple of panic buttons, and a few days later, when I called the number on the business card he'd given me and invited him over for a drink. A photo of Lana is on my mantle, but Derek probably didn't notice it.
Look, Avery, I'm glad I could help you out tonight.
I pause, balancing on one leg, my other foot sliding into one of my high heels. But
it's just sometimes I feel like all we have is this.
He lifts his hand and gestures above the bed.
But isn't this pretty good?
I give a little laugh, then grab his fingers and kiss them.
It's been a few months, and I like you. I know we both said it was okay to see other people, but maybe we shouldn't.
Come on, you're 10 years younger than I am. At 26, he's actually 15 years my junior.
You can't really think.
I stop myself when I see the hurt on Derek's face. The air between us feels heavy and tight, something I've never experienced before. Let's talk about this more tomorrow. I really have to go. My poor dog has never been left alone this long.
Okay.
Derek gets up to walk me to the door, naked. I love his sense of chivalry and his uninhibitedness. I'm just not in love with him.